Laura's Friday. Picture this, from October 28th, 2011. It's 2011, and cool things are still dangerous. Mike Flores uses modern examples to demonstrate how you can shape your endgame to where you want to be and why you shouldn't be distracted by shiny things along the way. Part 1. It's 2011, and cool things are still dangerous.
I have it locked up, obviously. DI cards. DI cards, exactly. If you turn infinity, i.e. the I in DI, on its side, what do you get? That's right. 8. Just so many that I have to discard my second copy of Phantasmal Image. I have already counterspelled 2 copies of Green Sun Zenith, and a quick perusal of his graveyard, thanks to Nefalia Drownyard, indicates that he will not be drawing 2 copies of Thrun the Last Troll. In addition to Drownyard Beatdown, there are 2 Snapcaster Mages in play, clocking him by 2s and 4s. No, Snapcaster Mages are not the fastest clock, but he has basically nothing. Nada and zilch. And because of Drownyard, his chances are getting slimmer by the turn. Trusty Druidic Satchel mises YT, another basic swamp. Now a drowned catacomb. How have people not picked up on this yet? A couple of little guys and a couple of Dungrove Elders are all gone the way of the dodo. I actually typed dojo there the first time. Equally applicable, I guess. Counter this, edict that. Most of the watchers have started to fade, realizing this game is a foregone conclusion. Just him and me and a fair stretch of life. Spell. Whatever spell. Mana leak that. Spell again. Dissipate. Larry Swayze, multiple-time Open Top 8 competitor and Glass Cannon progenitor, logs onto the match. Watch this, Larry, I think to myself. Am I calling myself Larry now? Primeval Titan. Resolves? I can stop the Titan several different ways, but decide to let it stick. Ooh, I joyously rock in my chair. I'm gonna have a Primeval Titan. I look over to his lands. Next to his myriad forests are now an Ink Moth Nexus and Kessig Wolf Run. What were you thinking? This is atrocious! Even if you get a Primeval Titan, what then? You can't even attack this turn, the way the board is. Yeah, we were gonna copy that, and then what? Get our 6/6 Phantasmal Image killed for free by a Wolf Run drive-by? Get raced by a Titan and the Ink Moth Nexus? And the inevitable next Nexus, anyway? What lands were we even gonna get? I mean, Ghost Quarter is nice-ish, but we have to answer both of his special lands, and he can Wolf Run our illusion before we can use it. Not much choice anymore. I am certainly not gonna get attacked by that thing. I have to play Phantasmal Image to copy Snapcaster Mage to rebuy Tribute to Hunger in order to get rid of the Titan while leaving up Counterspell mana. I could have picked Geth's Verdict or one of the Doom Blades, but Druidic Satchel has ensured mana is plentiful, and I might as well pick up the extra life. I have a fistful of Think Twice and Dissipate, but we both know what is going to happen next. He plays the DI land, taps the bejesus out of them, and puts 7 or 8 poison on me. I draw some cards or draw some more cards. Brother, can you spare a Ring Flesh? At least Fortuna doesn't spite me with a Go for the Throat or something. What did Wirtho bring me up learning? Any game you lose with a counterspell in your hand was probably your own fault? Brother, I got 3. Failure. Jaws of Victory. Extend the virtual hand. GG. What the hell just happened?
Part 2. Visualization Introduction.
My favorite part of Magic, life, is the concept of visualization in goal setting. I talked about it quite a bit some years ago on the Top 8 Magic podcast, and some of that stuck. It stuck so well with young Gavin Verhey that he used the concept as part of a bigger bag of tricks, I'm sure, to get himself to ostensibly his Destiny's best endgame, mising a job in Wizards R&D at Wizards of the Coast. The cool thing about back then is that I didn't know 1% of what I know today about how to utilize this skill back then, and it was still powerful. We can talk... We can talk about visualization a lot of different ways and apply it to different in-game. and like Gavin did, out of game situations. But for our purposes, I will summarize it like this. Basically, what you want to do is create a clear picture of what the universe is going to look like at the end of the game. In a game of Magic, you can substitute the board with the universe. Got it? Great. Now go do whatever you have to make the board look like that. Part of the success of combo decks for players of various levels is that they come pre-visualized. Individual players don't have to stretch too many brain muscles to make the board look like that, because they know exactly what the board is going to look like in the games they should win. Therefore, even weaker players can often get where they need to get with a combo deck. Fast combo decks, especially, get all kinds of extra percentage by coming pre-visualization loaded. For example, I can evaluate a hand of a super-fast combo deck like Cephalid Breakfast and determine exactly which decisions I need to make the board look exactly the way I want it to on the last turn of the game. You know, like turn three on a slow draw. Back in the late 1990s, at the dawn of the first real competitive combo decks, Prosbloom in this case, Bloom was in fact one of my group's favorite decks to test. Every game was so tense. It was the willy or won't we, every single time. And while we knew what the conclusion of a successful game would be, how we got to that place was often such a rewarding journey. There were the freebie games, where you would just hit your correct lands, play an uncontested squandered resources, then natural order into Cadaverous Bloom on the third turn, and that would be that. And then there were other games. The games where you used every single impulse like a control player might to hit land drops, until the other guy's flaccid spike feeder beatdown might actually become relevant. Now your natural balances were like quadruple stone rains. You didn't even necessarily care if they resolved. Did you have three for the mana leak? Did the opponent really understand what was happening if the board looked even? Part of the problem that players who, quote, like blue or, quote, like control, but don't actually do well with blue control at a high level, is that there can be very difficult to imagine what the ideal universe into play. They can't necessarily evaluate opening hands very well because they don't necessarily know where they are going to or how to get there. The path is muddy, and it can be unclear if certain cards are even good. The same control deck can spit out a hand that is both an auto win and an auto lose if kept, depending on what you are playing. It is much less pronounced for the folks in Beatdown or Combo to register this kind of uncertainty. A first turn Stromkirk Noble is pretty much always where you want to be for a red deck. On balance, one of the things I've always liked about tap-out control decks, or at least utilized in my development of them, and generally greater success when contrasted with draw-go-type control decks, is that I always knew what my path my opponent was going to take, meaning I could park a great big body in the middle of that path, simultaneously advancing my own route to the imagined endgame. I always felt like the opponent was rushing in a very straight line. Yes, sometimes he could be going very quickly, or had the potential to collide with tremendous force, but I could either do something annoying, boomerang his Jitte or its proposed carrier while he had four tapped, or just put something gigantic in the way. Tap-out control decks have Magical Christmas Land easier to visualize, because we all know what a tapped dragon in the red zone looks like, or a battlefield cluttered with angry, if willingly defensive, 1-1 illusions looks like. Counterspell / removal ones, perhaps a bit less so, especially now that beatdown creatures have gotten so much better. Am I supposed to let that in? If I ignore that, what is the implication on my poor little Snapcaster Mage? Do I have to find another way to win? Or just use a removal spell or... nebulous.
Part 3. Who wins?
Great visionaries are masters of this skill. At the risk of not humble bragging, the former CEO of Apple wrote a nice blurb for / recommendation of my second book, claiming it should be, quote, on every marketer's bookshelf. Admittedly, that CEO is John Sculley, not Steve Jobs, but to be fair, Sculley invented the Pepsi Challenge and took Apple from $800 million to $8 billion or so. He probably knows what he's talking about. Now, obviously, I was alluding to Jobs. Top of mind to me, even if he weren't on every taxi cab in New York or so much in the news these days. Who was the visionary's visionary? He imagined a world where computers were beautiful and ultimately without buttons. The first idea essentially saved Apple, as loads of incoming college girls flocked to blue iMac computers in the mid-1990s. and the latter gave us generation after generation of increasingly aesthetic iPods, until the grown-up, maximally functional version that will ultimately supplant the laptop computer. Now, if you look at a 10-year-old iPod, it is pretty clear that even in 2001, an age when we already had the technology of ID19, Trix, Tinker, and Napster, that we didn't have the technology required for an iPad. But so clear was his vision, despite so many competitors encouraging him to sell out to Michael Dell or some other mainline computer manufacturer, Steve's vision was so clear and powerful that he, one, actually forced the universe to bend around that vision in order to produce the requisite technology, and two, won. In 2009, or 2008, when it was probably scripted, this was kind of a joke. There was a YouTube video, I think The Onion did, of like, it's like even more buttons than an iPad, right? Mm-hmm. You could watch it, I guess. Lots of people keyed on the fact that Steve didn't like buttons, or in the above Onion video is one implementation of that nudge, nudge, wink, wink, until you get to the real punchline of, haha, he actually figured it out. And it is cooler than any of us could have imagined. So here's the lesson. Whoever can visualize the clearer, more real picture of the universe will typically get it. In magic, as in war, that usually means winning. If you ever play one of those games where you kind of play the cards you draw, maybe trish a little, dither here and there, maybe off the top, the kind of stretches for a while, and sometimes you win, but often you don't. The reason you don't, you usually don't, is that these give-and-go games rarely come with some kind of picture of how you want the world to look at the end of the game. If you aren't dictating the picture of the universe, you are usually ceding that to the opponent. And guess what? Then he gets to pick what your reality is going to be. Or if he doesn't, either, then it is really up to the cards. You're not playing the cards. They're playing you. Remember the line I talked about a week or two ago? Brian Kibler versus Edgar Flores? Brimstone Volley versus Manalik? One line ultimately successful was to go with the baseline operations of the teamer deck, respecting Liliana, and playing to jockey for control against a deck that probably had stronger control capabilities. The other was to craft an end state with one's own hands, to change the course of a mighty river, to get us to a specific spot where Brimstone Volley would be lethal. This line, if you recall, would have been more successful. Now, before you think I've gone all New Agey or something, visualization as a tool to affect the formation of reality still has to obey the rules of our physical universe. If you need to draw a certain sequence of cards in a limited amount of time and the top of your deck isn't agreeing with you, you almost necessarily lose the ability to craft a particular outcome. Though, you can make the argument that certain cheaters put themselves into the positions they imagine while obeying the laws of the physical universe, if not the game. On balance, you might have the $16,000 lightning helix. Reasonable men can differ on which line to pick. For that game, the professor picked the right one.
Part 4. So what happened?
One of the really cool things about playing this way is collaboration with your opponent. When you get it right, it's really like you are playing on the same team instead of opposing teams. You ever get in the zone and almost literally see what is about to happen right before it happens? You know what is coming down, where, and have the exact right card, play, whatever, to anticipate and exploit whatever that is? When you are dictating the march toward an imagined eventual picture of the universe, your opponent really will do what you want. Some of you know exactly what I am talking about right now. The other guy is tapping for some ineffectual 2-for-1 while you are spending your mana and cards to take control, even if you're playing a beatdown deck, and paint the picture of stage 3. It's uncanny. What happened in the Primeval Titan game is that I successfully imagined the situation and steered the game into a spot where I was copying Primeval Titan with Phantasmal Image. I just imagined one where I wasn't going to win. I think that I got an inkling of how cool it would be to copy a Primeval Titan. I had never done that. So when the Primeval Titan came up, I didn't counterspell it, so I could copy it, which we now know ended in disaster. Dial it back just one or two paragraphs. Remember, when we are talking about how the opponent sometimes seems to be working with you, often that is because he is working towards the exact same end state that you are. He just doesn't realize such a state would result in his losing. When I was doing commentary at the Open Series event in Nashville, I made no bones about being most impressed by Brian Sondag and his Wolf Run Ramp deck, but I was most impressed by Christian Valenti's play against that deck, Where most Solar Fair players kind of sat there and waited ineffectually for Sondag to kill them, Christian figured out that he had to be in the right place at the right time to win games, even if he wasn't ultimately the open champion. In one game, Valenti successfully defended himself against all four copies of Inkmoth Nexus, which is pretty impressive for a deck that only has three Doomblades. He had to visualize what Sondag was going to do and put himself in a position to exploit those plays. Sondag cooperated by attacking with one Inkmoth Nexus each turn and attempting to go lethal with Wolfrun, turn after turn. Valenti, therefore, had time, and to be fair, the luck, to draw into enough Doomblades and Snapcaster Mages to parry each of the near-lethal attacks, attack after attack after attack after solo attack. From my perspective watching, it was something like this, albeit to a lesser degree. There's a YouTube video here, and I'll describe what it is in a second. For those of you who don't know, Daigo Umehara is one of the world's most successful Street Fighter players. The above clip is one of the most famous and impressive comebacks in the history of competitive Street Fighter. Umehara, Ken, was knocked down to one pixel of health. At this point, any special move by his opponent's Chun-Li would have knocked him out, and even a blocked special move deals chip damage. Daigo's opponent, Justin Wong, commanded Chun-Li to attempt a vicious 15-hit combo. Remember, any special move hit, even blocked, would prove lethal for Daigo's Ken. So instead, in a brilliant combination of strategy, identifying the inevitability, and not in a good way, of blocking and execution, again, the most impressive sequence ever for that game, Daigo chose instead to parry each of Chun-Li's strikes, timing the parry and counter-strike within four of 30 frames of animation each time, 15 times in a row. Did you see he had to jump and parry in the middle? Valenti's defense was, to me, quite parallel to this. Christian had to conserve Doomblades and wait for the right spots to use them. Due to his configuration, he also had to draw Snapcaster Mage and leave up the right amount of mana on the right turns. About three Inkmoth Nexuses in, with Sondag basically out of gas, I made the comment that this would be a great time to top deck Sun Titan, and I think that the vast majority of players, if they top deck Sun Titan, would have slapped it down, rebought Phantasmal Image, copied Sun Titan, and covered their side of the battlefield with big monsters, and, you know, card advantage. Because that is Solar Flare's big play. That is the illustration at the end of the Solar Flare how-to manual. That is the picture of the battlefield that everyone is going for. That is the one that kids write home about. Isn't it cool that is how all their scribblings to mommy start? Remember what I said about sometimes it seems like the opponent is working with you? The vast majority of Solar Flare players, if they top deck Sun Titan, would have executed on exactly that right home worthy sequence. Christian had enough mana to make that play, but not enough to do that and hang back for the Snapcaster Mage duo. Ergo, the vast majority of Solar Flare players would have then lost the game on the spot to the fourth Inkmoth Nexus. It's 2011, and cool things are still dangerous. Be careful what you wish for, because you might just get it. Love, Mike. I wrote most of this article sitting in a cubicle at 100 Center Street, New York City, while serving on jury duty on my iPad 2. You know what's cool?
What?
I don't know if you remember, but we met Christian Valenti in San Diego. He came up to us in line when we were waiting to get into the regional championship.
Oh, we did?
He introduced himself to us. We did, yeah. And I did not even remember when I picked this article that we had met Christian Valenti just a couple of months ago, me and you.
That's so funny. Together.
Hilarious, yeah. I remember he played awesome. He played awesome. Although Sondag won. And of course, Wolfrun Ramp became like one of the main decks in Standard that year. But I remember being super impressed. Like, you know, there's that point in Who's the Beatdown where the Slivers guy gets Crystalline Sliver Worship against me. And he's just like, I got my combo. And I just killed him. Mm-hmm. Like, I think people just, they're like, oh man, I'm going to get the Sun Titan. I'm going to get the Phantasmal Image out of my graveyard with the Sun Titan. It's going to copy the Sun Titan. I'm going to get so much card advantage. Valenti just didn't do it, because if he did it, then he wouldn't have been able to leave up, like, whatever, four mana for Snapcaster Mage Doomblade, and he would have died to the last Inkmon Nexus, but he played it right. You know what else I like? The part about, like, you play cooperatively with your opponent.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about the inevitability mode of a burn deck in Modern, I really feel like that's how it is. You know, recently, Shaheen Serrani, you know, he said he hung up the wand, right? So I called up Shaheen the day he announced he was going to hang up the wand, and I'm like, are you hanging up the wand or are you just hanging up the quill? He's like, I'm hanging up the quill, but I think I'm hanging up the wand. And I tried to get him into pre-modern, so he might get into pre-modern, because nobody really hangs up the wand. But my favorite thing I ever learned is I'm playing with Shaheen in a fun game, and it's like turn two, and I float a Rift Bolt, right? So, you know, what's a blue-white player do whenever you float a Rift Bolt? What do they do on turn three? Every time, Roman.
Cast a Teferi Time Raveler?
They cast a Teferi Time Raveler. Why do they do that, Roman?
It's to counter your Rift Bolt.
Because they never read the danger of cool things. Right, so they're like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if I countered that Rift Bolt with Teferi Time Raveler? And what happens to them 100% of the time when they tap out for Teferi Time Raveler to counter your Rift Bolt?
You tell me.
You know what happens. And anybody who's ever been in this situation knows what happens. They take 10 the next turn because they're now tapped out. You just slam your hand onto the table. They're like, congratulations, you got my Rift Bolt. Take these next 3 to 4 burn cards and my Monastery Swift Spear and my Goblin Guide, whatever I had in play. It's so cool to ferry your Rift Bolt. Come on. Roman, you wanted to record tonight. You're being uncharacteristically quiet. Did you not like this article? Should I have picked another one?
I did like this article. I think that I'm trying to give it some thought about like how to better shape my games of Magic. So I feel like a lot of the times when I'm playing Limited, this article very much applies to how I want like my board states to look at the end of each game, depending on what deck I draft or I build and sealed. But I don't know. I like the idea of visualizing like, this sort of back and forth and playing with your opponent to get to achieve like the end game that you want.
Yeah. So I think it's a little different now because contemporary Magic's so fast and like effects are so snowbally, right? Like,
right.
Like, Fable of the Mirror Breaker won all 3 Pro Tours so far this year. So, like, it's really snowbally. But there are still, like, a lot of format. I mean, I guess Modern isn't that bad. You know, the Tron decks did well. Like, they probably can imagine lacing together 3 Urza's pieces and getting an Ulamog. But I guess the scam guy probably also is like, maybe they're not visualizing the end game. They're like, you know what would be an awesome opening hand? A Thoughtseize and a Dothy, and I'm going to take his stupid Ulamog on the second turn. Wouldn't that be great? Like, it's the same thing. Like, you just need to be able to paint a picture of what you want the game to look like. Because if you have that picture, then you can play towards it, you know?
I definitely think that, and, like, one like mistake that I've been playing a lot of Limited lately, and one mistake that I see people make is they use like certain combat tricks or removal spells very early, and that usually ends up locking them out of a given game. Does that make sense?
Because in Limited you only have so much removal, right?
Right. So. Yeah. So like the way, you know, a lot of games that I play sometimes go is that, you know, I'm willing to take 5 hits from a 2/2. And not use my Terminate because that Terminate is further 6/6 that's going to kill me inevitably, right?
But not 10 hits from a 2/2, right?
Right. I feel like there's a lot of games I've either won or lost because it's come down to how you really sequence cards in the right order and how you project the game going for a number of turns. And if you're too short-sighted, you might just make a fatal mistake that costs you the entire game, even though you made it on like turn like 3 or 4 or something. Like I think a lot of games that I play that I lose or I see people lose are because they make bad playing decisions early on without kind of visualizing the longer time frame of that game.
Yeah, I think that is certainly a failure of imagination. Like, I think there's like this concept of like a failure of imagination, which is just like, you know, I'm talking in this article about picturing what the end game is going to look like. And I mean, I very definitively remember losing a PTQ. So I'm playing for the slot in a 3-man PTQ. And I'm so far, I won game 1 already, right? I'm so far ahead, I can't even imagine how my opponent can win. But you know who could imagine how he could win? My opponent. He put it together. Just put it together over a couple of turns. I could not visualize him possibly coming back. And, you know, if I had been able to visualize it, maybe I would have been able to stop him. Because he put it together. So, it's interesting, like... I'm going to play in a Pioneer RCQ this weekend with a deck I've probably never played before. And so I wonder if I'm going to have the ability to visualize how to get there.
Well, that's like one good thing that comes with practice and understanding your deck, right? Is to know like how the cards are going to interact over the course of a game, right?
Yeah, like Modern, for example, you know, I can always like predict pretty well like what my opponent's going to do. And if I know what my opponent's going to... Because I know, you know what cards are in their deck, what they're going to do, how much damage they're going to take from their lands, stuff like that. It lets me, like, craft how I want to develop my side of the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
Versus, like, in Pioneer, I just don't know the decks as well. And, like, I'm gonna play Boros. You know, have you seen this Boros deck? It's just, like...
The Pia deck.
Chandra's Mom. Yeah, Chandra's Mom. And then, like, all this exile stuff to get 1/1s.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a really powerful set of, you know... First of all... Chandra's Mom is a good card to begin with. Like 2/3 for 2 is good in red, and then obviously has this unreal set of abilities. But like, you know, what does that deck really do? It just puts a bunch of 1/1s into play that have haste.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, I'm gonna visualize hitting people for 1, I guess.
But like, I guess with that deck, I mean, I haven't played the deck, but I can imagine that the way you're sculpting your games are around like Runaway Steamkin plus Pia. To generate a whole lot of tokens in one big turn, or maybe not one big turn, but like I feel like you're not. Are you really playing those games where you're tapping out for Pia on turn 2? I mean, maybe in some matchups you are, but
no idea. I'm gonna get the deck from LAN like tomorrow, and I've never even taken a test draw with it. Wow. I don't even know what the 75 is.
Okay,
he told me he thinks it's the best, and it's in. What he actually did was he called me like 2 weeks ago, and he said, "Do you have 2 extra steam vents?" So on one hand, I was just like, I only play 2 Steam Vents in my Modern deck, right? I'm not Steam Vents, sorry, Sacred Foundry. I only play 2 Sacred Foundry in my Modern deck, so I'm like, I'd probably just have to. But then I remembered, there was like, Bella had made a comment once that she liked Izzet and Boros, right? So I thought that meant she would like play FNM with me every week. That turned out to not be true. But I bought like 2 copies of Izzet and Boros so that we could both play Izzet and Boros in Standard.
Mm-hmm.
So I just have a complete extra copy of like Steam Vents and Sacred Foundry because those were legal in Standard at the time. So I easily had 2 extra Sacred Foundry and I'm like, what do you need these for? He's like, I'm making a Boros deck for you to win the RCQ with. So LAN is the master. He's like the best deck designer right now.
I miss LAN. I haven't talked to him in a while.
Dude. I'm going to hang out with Lan and Johnny tomorrow.
At MK?
At MK. Johnny's back.
So you're doing it in person now?
We've been doing it in person at Lan.
MK is movie like, club for
yeah.
Those not on the know.
But Johnny got an apartment on Houston Street like 2 weeks ago, so we've been doing it at Johnny's.
Nice.
So, yep. That's what we're doing tomorrow. You know, we played a duplicate sealed on Friday. That was fun.
Oh, I thought of another example, actually, going back to the article, so we don't get too sidetracked right away. Because we've only been talking for, it's only been 30 minutes so far into this episode. So
give me an example, brother.
All right. So I was at FNM on Friday, and we were drafting March of the Machine. One of my favorite sets of the last, you know, year or so. And I drafted this like crazy Yorian 5-color deck in true Roman fashion because I'm known for drafting these like wacky decks.
And you have a Yorian?
Yeah, so in March of the Machine you have Yorian because there's a bonus sheet of legendary cards from across the multiverse. Did you play this format at all?
I only played it at the pre-release.
All right, so you can draft Yorian.
Oh, maybe I played it. I think your son and his hetero life partner and me, the Hot Dog State University, I think we team drafted it once.
Yeah. So I guess this is actually kind of 2 parts. So first part is drafting my deck. So when I draft Yorian, I know in Limited, like, one reason why I like Yorin is because against other mid-range decks, you're always up a card and you have this incredible piece of value that can just win you the game the longer the game goes. So one thing that I knew beforehand, you know, or after I picked that card, is kind of visualizing what cards do I want to combo with Yorin. And the answer is a lot of the battles that have Enter the Battlefield effects, or creatures that have ETB effects, or also you want to
look for... Cause you can blink battles with Yorin, right?
Correct. So I got two copies of my favorite card in that format, Invasion of Amonkhet. Do you know what that one does?
You invade Amonkhet. Amonkhet
has been invaded. Yeah, exactly.
It's the reanimating one, right?
Yeah, like both players mill three cards, and they discard a card, you draw a card, and then once you flip it, it becomes a copy of a creature in a graveyard and has an ETB ability with it. So
yeah, people play that in like Atraxa Constructed. That's why I know
about it. Right. Yeah, and then also like an important card that I drafted two copies of, and I wielded one of these, was a Blade Burgeoning. It's a 3-mana enchantment that makes your land tap for 1 mana more of any color you want. But when it enters the battlefield, you get to make an incubate token. So you can like flicker it. You can like flicker it with Yorin and put it on an untapped land and have 2 mana open to flip your incubate token immediately.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. Anyway, so part one of this was, you know, visualizing. You know, if I have a Yorin. And I did play 60 cards, and I did 3 of SFNM. But also, what cards, you know, mesh well with Yorin? You know, ETB effects, mana ramp, defensive spells to make sure that, you know, the longer the game goes, you're inevitably going to win. And I remember I played against a player playing Blue-White Knights in round one. And he was a newer player and had not drafted the set before, I think, and... But he was, you know, interested in learning. So during the games, I think he played very aggressively, where he was using like his aerial boosts at the wrong time. Like he was basically trying to like make these trades in combat that would just like win a short term, like get, you know, kill my guy in combat, but he would just lose to whatever I tapped out for the next turn. Instead, where he should be, you know, trying to chip in damage here and there, and then win with like aerial boost in like one turn when I tap out or something.
Oh, so he was just, like, blowing all of his stuff before it mattered.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. He was going, like, way
too... Classic, I did 19 points of damage burn player.
Yes, that's, perfect example. And I remember, you know, talking with him afterwards, and he was like, you know, I think I just got kind of flooded, and, you know, I don't know what went wrong. And in the sideboard, he wasn't playing the blue-white battle from the format, which is, like, the card you play in the Knights deck. It's Invasion of...
Wait, the one that Xerix. Makes Infinity Knights?
No. The one that's... It's two blue-white. When it ETBs, you bounce a creature your opponent controls. And then once you flip it, it becomes an XX creature where X is equal to, or star creature where star is equal to the number of creatures you control, and it has flying. So one thing I was trying to explain to him, because he was interested in learning, and, you know, I don't think he understood this at the time, was the way the Knights deck operates in that format is you put creatures in play. It's step one is putting knights in play and creatures in play, but step two is finding ways to out-tempo your opponent to snowball value. So for example, there's knights that get bigger you know, you play a knight on ETB. There's a knight that gets first strike when another knight enters the battlefield. So you're basically setting up turns where you put things into play, and then you kind of overwhelm your opponent out-tempoing them with these cards. And that battle Invasion of Xerix is like a perfect card for the strategy, because you're basically undoing your whole opponent's last turn, and then you also either that turn or the next turn just put in like a 5/5 with flying into play. And now your opponent
is this a question of the opponent? Is the opponent like not visualizing right, or the opponent just not knowing to play a good card?
I mean, I think it's twofold, and you know, I think that, you know, part one is they should have played the good card, right? But part two, I think, is in the games we played, the way they played was not necessarily with a plan in mind. It was just to try and just go aggro, throw things against you, make bad attacks, and then, you know, can't do anything once you draw, you know, it's like turn 8, and I'm already at like a higher, you know, I'm still at like 10 life or whatever, right? Like I won both those games at like 6 to 10 life. But I think that one thing
I think I know what you're saying. I think there's a lot of players who they have resources, right? They don't utilize their resources to the degree that they're supposed to. And then they claim they lost to being flooded.
Right.
Right?
And this was definitely...
That sounds like a thing people do.
It was a newer player, so you know I don't want to like... They had things to learn, but I definitely think that's like a smaller version of bigger mistakes that you know better players make on average, right?
I think in the article itself, I think that the thing that I'm indicting, and this kind of goes back to a smart thing Aaron Forsythe once told me. So Aaron Forsythe once said that like, when you get to, you go from being a competent Magic player to actually being good, right? You know, like competent is just like, I attack before I cast my spell, you know, whatever the rule of thumb is, right? But at some point you're actually good. And people who are actually good just undo all of the rule of thumbs. They just play opposite from how you're supposed to play in book, right? So maximizing, like, what are all the things we're supposed to do? Tap all your mana every turn. Maximize card advantage, right? Like, stuff like that. When you're playing at a really high level, you don't tap all your mana every turn because you might need to leave open mana for Doomblade because your opponent was going to, you know, Nexus you out, right? Like, anyway, it sounds to me like the player that you're talking about, right? He's in a zone either where he's just cresting competence. Maybe he's not even there yet, right? Versus, like, really having a deep understanding about the things that matter in a game,
mm-hmm.
right? And the absolute minimum of that is to play the right cards. But he's also, I mean, it just sounds to me like he's just not visualizing how the game is supposed to go, right? I think that's what you're kind of trying to get at,
like,
right?
I think their assumption was, I'm playing an aggro deck, I just need to draw creatures and then I'll win, but if I don't, I lose. But in actuality, it's more about crafting these very special turns to, like, to know when to attack, right? Or to know when to use your combat trick or removal to...
It's like one of those things, like, damage. When you see a good play, wait a second, find the better play, right?
And yeah.
I mean, it sounds like this player just isn't equipped for that yet. Roman, what is, like, the most exciting sort of, like, visualization end game you ever participated in? Was it perhaps... you visualizing that your opponent would play a second turn Grizzlebrand and attack you with it, and then you visualized a deflecting palm into your hand, and then you visualize them being like, oh, shoot, them just dealing seven to themselves in the hopes of finding an answer to a deflecting palm that is not yet resolved, and then you visualizing him not getting it in those seven cards, and then you
cards.
Visualizing him drawing another seven cards. Is that perhaps the most exciting?
I mean, on the small scale, sequence? That's why I sided it in, right? To visualize the situation in which that could arise, right?
Did you really?
Yeah.
I don't know if I would have had Deflecting Palm in my deck. I mean, and it was in whatever. You played my regional PTQ deck, right? Like, you're just like, what was your 75 from the regional PTQ? And you played it except for you didn't play Kataki.
Because the store was sold out.
Yeah. So instead you played Ancient Grudge? Like, or something, so you still had, like,
a
Stomping
Grudge?
Did
I play Ancient Grudge? I don't think I played Ancient Grudge. I think I still had a
You had a Stomping Ground that we tried to cut. You're like, I can't get Kataki. So I need to keep this green.
Let me look.
So for like a year, people still had a Stomping Ground in their deck. That was the funniest thing to me, because, like, at all the official WotC channels, they would show, like, this is the example Boros Burn deck with the one Stomping Ground that doesn't cast any cards. But yes, that was a sweet win. But you, like, imagined, like, he's going to get his stuff. You imagined him getting his plan, and you would want to find a way to beat him even if he got his plan, right?
Correct.
Is that basically what we're getting at?
Correct. Wait, I'm looking now at the list. I did have Revelry, yes. Oh, wait, I had one Kataki. Because I had one they had, I think.
So that was, I always thought that was hilarious. But what about other ones? Like, think about like how you put together an end game, you know? Mm-hmm. I can tell you, I had an utter failure once.
What about, you know what? I was, okay, before that, I was thinking about the deck, the Approach of the Second Sun deck and playing.
Yeah, I thought you would think about
making
that.
The switch to Ip New Rivulet.
Oh, because the alternate kill?
Well, no, because you would mill yourself faster, right? You would.
Well, that was one of the play patterns, yeah.
Yeah.
I guess that's a cool thing to figure out the first time you do it, but sometimes you mill your opponent out. Mm-hmm. I had a game, I actually, it's a happy ending because I won the qualifier, but I lost this game. So I always ask people, have you ever lost a game that you resolved three cruel ultimatums in your opponent? Like they all actually resolved. No one would ever lose that game if I did, right? So my opponent had Sidraxis Spectre. He was playing Jund, and I visualized my opening hand. I'm like, what's the hand I want against Jund? And I just want to have a ton of Spreading Seas, right? So I had a bunch of Spreading Seas, so I totally mana screwed my opponent, right? But my opponent next leveled me. He used the blue from my Spreading Seas to cast Sidraxis Spectre. Isn't that cool?
That's pretty cool.
That was his sideboard. It was his sideboard strategy, right? So, I knew the play, right? And the play was I have to let him hit me with Sidraxis Spectre. He hits me with the Sidraxis Spectre. I will discard my own Sidraxis Spectre. And then I had enough mana to flashback the Sidraxis Spectre and lightning bolt him to death in one turn, right? Because I had done 15 points of damage with Cruel Ultimatums, right? But it's just so ingrained in you to not get hit by a Hypnotic Spectre. I lightning bolted his Sidraxis Spectre instead. But I needed to get hit by the Sidraxis Spectre, right? Because then I can unearth it and it gets haste, right? Then I attack for lethal. But so instead, I lightning bolted his Sidraxis Spectre instead. So I didn't have the lightning bolt for his face. I now can hard cast the Sidraxis Spectre, but that doesn't win the game, right? And he just top decked a Bloodbraid Elf, killed my Sidraxis Spectre, killed me. So that's how you lose a game that you resolved three Cruel Ultimatums. And I correctly visualized how to win the game, and I failed to execute. Are you proud of me that I failed to execute there, Roman?
So proud.
Are you proud of me that I, at a minimum, that I figured out that I needed to get hit by the Sidraxis Spectre? That's kind of
that. That's pretty cool, right?
It's not cool. It's not cool to not actually do the right thing.
I played an interesting match where I lost on this turn, where I attacked with, this is limited, I attacked in Lord of the Rings. I attacked with a Ring Bearer on level 3 of the ring, and my opponent made the correct block of blocking with more creatures than needed to get enough triggers for his Gimli to be able to fight my last creature and then lethal me the next turn. Because on level 3 of the ring, they have to, if you block with something, it gets sacked at the end of combat. So I just assumed my opponent would just block with like one or chump block. They block with three things, they found a way to lethal me that I didn't see.
It is always cool when you find a cool play that actually wins the game.
Yeah.
It is less cool when you find a cool play that seems cool and then
loses. You lose the game.
that's not good. Are you playing any? So you're currently qualified, right?
I'm qualified
have to win this weekend to equal you? Yeah. And I have like, I have no good Pioneer finishes this season. I don't even have a top 8.
Well, you have two chances this weekend, right?
I don't. So Saturday, Bella's moving back to Michigan on Monday, so I'm spending Saturday with Bella instead of playing in the two slaughter.
So what about
do you approve of me not playing in the two slaughter to instead play with Bella? We're
going to
play Resident Evil 2 all day. Okay.
Yeah.
Sunday, I have a one slaughter, but it's also a $1,000 tournament.
And that's so, but you also won at that store last time.
I did win at that sword the last time, yes. But I top forward at the one that has a two slaughter on Saturday, the last time I played there. So, but yeah, I'm choosing Bella instead of two slaughter. So I'm just going to have to. Look, man, me and me and Sacred Foundry have a good record.
Yeah, your deck also has another unbeatable card you played, Chain to the Rocks.
Yeah, I am good at Boros.
I'm surprised you haven't brought up sooner that this deck has Chain to the Rocks in it.
I told you I don't know the 75. Man just said he made me a deck and that was the best. He's just gonna hand it to me at Johnny's tomorrow. I have to remind him so he remembers to bring it.
Well, good luck. So right now, I mean, I'm not playing a ton of stuff. So it's kind of, there's kind of like a lull because there's no new standard set and there's no RCQs because I've been qualified since like May.
Oh, I'm so good. I'm always qualified. I'm just going to make fun of Mike and then he'll have to qualify so that I don't have to room alone and be sad at the RC.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe we'll run into Christian Valencia again.
That'd be pretty cool. We can tell him we do this episode. I will be going to MagicCon Vegas though in about a month. And there is
What happened the last time you played in Vegas, Roman?
I got top 8 at the limited open event.
Fake Grand Prix.
The Grand Prix. So if it's I do fake I have, Grand Prix, I have but to do it like again three this times time, the people. Because this time there's actually freaking PT invites on the line.
There was PT invites on the line when you top 8 in the last one.
Well, they were like online PT invites that they retroactively gave to like 3 people, apparently.
That was some BS. Although one of them was Jeff Zhao. That's true. I played Jeff Zhao last week. I played him in pre-modern.
So I'll be playing that. 12 wins is a PT invite. It's pretty exciting.
Roman, I believe in you. If you're actually on the PT, I'm going to have to do well at the RC because that's unacceptable for you to be on the PT. And
while you're not.
Yeah, it's unacceptable. Like the RC is, I'm like, I can kind of chuckle and be like, yeah, my prejudice is doing pretty well. But the PT? Come on, Roman.
I'm going to get there eventually, man.
I believe in you. I'm just saying it's unacceptable for you to be on and not me.
If you don't, worst case scenario, if you don't queue this weekend for Atlanta, will you go to Atlanta to play Last Chance Qualifiers?
When is it?
End of December? Not December. It's like December 18th or something.
Oh, like the week before Christmas?
I think so. DreamHack Atlanta 2023. It is...
I don't know. Maybe
December 15th through the 17th.
Oh, that's like a week and a half before Christmas, maybe.
Yeah, because I'll probably fly from there straight to Jersey afterwards.
Oh, you're going to do Christmas up here?
Probably.
I think I'm going to go visit my parents for Christmas, but I'll only stay a few days. How long are you going to be up here? We can hang out.
I'm not sure yet. I was actually thinking because I'm moving on to a new project soon and I have the ability to work remotely, but I can't kind of go back and forth because
could you just move back?
Potentially. The answer is mostly yes.
Why don't you just like move into my building and we can like live like a bunch of Magic players live like near me, including David Tao, and we could just hang out and play Magic and go out and have fun. Remember in 2018 we just hung out like 3 nights a week, including like at Johnny's one night, and just like hung out with like every freaking Thursday, man. That was the best. That was the best. Must have been the best year of your life.
Yeah, we went to F&M. TRF. We went to like
standard. We would like standard F&M, hang out with Risa and Sash, go to Johnny's. It was like.
Wasn't there also like a Monday thing we went to at Montessi too? That was standard with Lan. I can't remember.
And we also recorded this podcast that year, week. We were just like really actually stapled at the hip. When did I spend any time with my kids? Who knows? So I'm visualizing you working remotely from New York instead of stupid LA and becoming a part of the pre-modern scene. That's what I'm visualizing.
You know, I might just take you up with that offer. If I don't move to New York, but the other option is I would just move to Jersey, but I would be just a train ride away.
Jersey, come on, man. If you can live in an apartment in L.A. and be like an independent adult, why couldn't you move into an apartment in New York?
Wait, what's your building? Where do you live again? You're in Bushwick?
I'm not going to say where I live on the podcast. I mean, I have like a bunch of, you know, probably fully 2 or 3 people so wandering around outside my building with binoculars. I live downtown Brooklyn right now.
Okay. I might, you know what, let's see how the next couple months play out, but I do have the ability to do that. It's not off the table.
I'm visualizing you moving back. And in fact, moving back as like a grown up instead of like last time when you lived here, you were living with your parents' house. But now I think you can live in your own house because you are a big, strong audio designer.
That I am.
Grown up audio designing guy. So that would be gas.
I think it would be.
All right. I think for the next one, we need to like just really get into gear. So I think that we should just do Who's the Beatdown again. That's just really the thing about this. The first time we did Who's the Beatdown was actually awesome. But I think like you have grown so much as a player. I haven't. I'm probably worse. But you have grown so much as a player since since we recorded that like 5 years ago. I think we should just like Who's the Beatdown version 2.0 Ancestral Recall next week.
I think it would be good to do because not only as a player, but you know, like when we record Who's the Beatdown, I was like a junior in college and like my life was very rocky at the time, right? Like it was,
yeah,
but I mean, not like, you know, life is always a little rocky, but things like it's just, I feel like I was such a kid, you know.
You were,
and that was like 5 years ago. I mean, I'm still a kid. I feel like a kid.
Yeah. At least. I mean, but you are now older than I was when I wrote Who's the Beatdown.
That's crazy to me. Really?
Yeah, I was 23 when I wrote Who's the Beatdown.
Wow. That's actually pretty wild to me.
Yeah.
But
try waking up one day when you're like, oh, I might be a writer, and you're 23 and you come to the realization that you're never going to write anything better than this. Try that at 23.
And that's what you'll be known for.
Yeah, and I'm like, this is... I didn't know at the time, right? I didn't know at the time I was going to be known for this for the rest of my life. Like, I knew I had written the best magic article of all time. But there had been way fewer magic articles at that point, right?
Like, one of the best, so like, TCG articles of all time, too.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's... But I wrote it, and I sent it in, and I'm like... I had already known that it was the best, right? I didn't know that it was going to just, like, 30 years later still be the best, you know what I mean? Or that we would still be playing Magic at this point and taking it seriously, or that I would have a Wikipedia entry because I wrote it, right? Like, I didn't know any of those things. But, like, I did know that I might never write anything better than this the rest of my life. That was something that, like, it was weird. I sent the button. I'm like, that was haunting, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's a really haunting feeling to have at 23.
So I think we should do it. I think it would give some cool perspective. And I think it's an article that's still just always relevant.
Yeah.
It's a timeless piece of magic literature.
And that is what the Ancestral Recall podcast strives to bring to the Canadian public.
As we are still being published on Face-to-Face Games. Hello, Canada.
So, yeah, so I think that'll be a better article than Picture This. I thought Picture This was better than it was when I was reading it tonight. I mean, it's okay. I was just like, oh, I think this is one of my best articles, but I don't think it's one of my best articles.
Maybe it's not like the most well known, but I think it's a pretty strong magic piece just because I think that's something a lot of players could learn from, is just to have better visualization overall. Right. I do think
visualization is an important tool. And I think like the description of like, imagine how you want the battlefield to look like at the end of the game. Right. Like, what does a winning battlefield look like? Get yourself there.
Right.
Those are important tools. But I think like there are 2000 other words in this article.
Maybe, but I think that's an important skill to have. I mean, even but like as someone who plays a lot of Limited, that's definitely an equally important part to both deck construction and playing your matches, right?
Yeah, I think it's actually a really important tool in Limited, especially the better you know the format, you know. So like
right. Because you have a more, you know, in-depth understanding of how the cards interact. Like, for example, like for the Throne of Eldraine set, or the next Eldraine set, I mean, I don't know what they're going to print exactly, but having, you know, me going into Vegas, having played X amount of drafts, you know, a large number of drafts, and understanding all the ins and outs and card interactions in the format, I think I can have a better visualization of how games are, you know, how I want my games to go compared to other people, right?
You certainly will. Is Cover Go Blue going to be there? Probably. He probably will, right?
Probably.
They pay him to
I hope
do
so.
All
I mean,
this.
He's my
can hang out
he's
there.
my good luck charm, so I hope
He's your daddy,
Yeah,
right?
he has some snacks for me like last time.
Daddy CGB.
Yeah, that's what got me through the last couple of rounds of that event.
All right, Roman. Am I gonna win this weekend? Are you visualizing me
I'm
joining you in the
visualizing you
RCP?
playing like a Steamkin and a Pia, and there's like 10,000 Thopter tokens in play.
Yeah. You know what my 1/1 tokens are gonna be, don't you?
One human like forest token.
They certainly are. They certainly are. What format is the RC?
Pioneer.
Pioneer.
It matches the
So I
constructed
can
format of the season.
dance with the girl what brung me.
Exactly.
Does anybody play standard anymore?
I do. I
Just on MTGA? Because I was playing
Yeah.
so much MTGA,
I played
but I
MTGA
haven't played
standard.
it in like 2 months.
I actually, this is a very small aside to this article. I've been playing this blue-black control deck that I've really enjoyed building, and it's sort of it's like it is kind of draw goey, kind of tap outy. But one card that I really love in standard is Jace, the Perfected Mind. Because
Yeah, that was like your first idea of decks we could play at
well,
RRC,
it's a
from what it
deck.
was.
It's a card that I like so much because it kind of just gets people out of nowhere, and it's like this alternate win
Oh, just
condition.
because you just like fireball them, right? Like
Yeah, like so,
one
but
shot kill.
like the first, so like the first iteration of the deck I built had four, and I suddenly realized that you don't need to mill them for 60 because they're already going to start the game at 53, and the game's going to go longer. But I actually
Wow, this is such a
realized.
philosophy of fire. Love it.
But I realized the actual number I want of Jace in that deck is two, so I can mill them for 30 because I think getting them to 30, there's a point in the game where I'm managing their resources, then I end up flashbacking like a memory deluge, find both my Jaces, and then, or I have a copy of Behold the Multiverse, or not Behold the Multiverse, Breach the Multiverse,
Breach the
and
Multiverse is my favorite way to deck people.
yeah, so
It's just
I
hilarious, right?
can navigate. So the way I'm navigating my games now is not to mill them for like 45, but it's actually to get them to 30 and then mill them in like one turn. And I'm also doing that through cards like Siphon Insight, which essentially deals a point of deck damage every time you cast it.
Roman, I don't even know what's in this deck and I'm in love with it. This sounds just like such a crafting the end game deck. Ship me this deck. Maybe I'll get back into standard
All
as a
right.
result of you shipping it to
You
me.
know, I don't know
I was
if
just gonna play mono white, and I can't imagine mono white could ever beat this deck in a
Oh,
million
no
years.
way. They take so
Never.
long to yeah, that so like you have a great matchup against decks like white and the ramp deck because they deal deck damage to themselves with cards like Invasion of Zendikar.
Is deck damage a word you just made up?
No,
I've never heard of this.
it's a term I learned watching a lot of Darkest Mage on stream. Because in Limited, your
Oh,
deck
the
count,
other Michael
the other Michael
J.
J, your deck count in Limited is actually, you can deck out a lot easier in Limited than Constructed, right? Because there's a lot of incremental card draw and some mill cards here and there, and games go longer in like Sealed, for example. So that's a term I picked up. But for example, like against the ramp deck, I just let their Atraxas resolve because they deck themselves for five cards. 5 to 7 cards.
Yeah, ship this deck to me. I'm actually excited to play Standard for the first time since the ban. You know, the bans happened. I was just like, oh man, it's weird. You know, Patrick O'Halloran Gannon, he gives me his MTGA free pack every time he wins a local tournament. He's a good apprentice that way. But I haven't even inputted the coupons into my MTGA because I haven't logged in 2 months. Side note: is there Midnight Hunt? When can I play Midnight Hunt again?
I don't know, man. I'd have to look. I don't know if it's coming back anytime soon. Because they're now rotating to newer sets.
Yeah, but Midnight Hunt is the best because that's the one I can't ever lose at. So it's the I guess I could just learn another limited format. That's another possibility.
You could. Anyway, we're getting off a little topic here, but I'll include my deck in the article on Face to Face.
Okay. So I have to wait till you publish this on Face to Face.
No, I'll send it to you right now.
All
right.
That's your decision. I will picture myself logging into an article that I wrote 10 years ago, listening to it on Face to Face Games, so that in exchange I will have the bribe of a blue-black deck list. Love it. Love Mike.
Love Roman. Right.